This is Democracy Now!
Today, we were able to stand before this court and say the Constitution protects trans people just like it protects everyone else. It is breaking no new ground to recognize that when you are prohibited from receiving something because of your sex, that it is the role of the courts to ensure that the government can satisfy its burden of showing that it has a good reason for doing so.
The Supreme Court appears poised to uphold Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming care for transgender youth after hearing arguments in a landmark case that could have major repercussions for transgender people across the country. We'll air excerpts of the arguments and speak to ACLU attorney Chase Strangio, who made history becoming the first openly transgender lawyer to argue before the Supreme Court. Then we continue our conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ronan Farrow on his new film, Surveilled, looking at the dangers of surveillance spyware.
Yes, there have been a number of documented cases of spyware technology being found on the phones of Palestinian activists, politicians. We talked to a Palestinian former Knesset member, politician, in the film, who puts forward the theory that Israel essentially uses the Palestinian populations as a laboratory for this technology.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Amnesty International has concluded Israel's committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. This is Amnesty researcher Budor Hassan.
We have documented Israel's perpetration of 3 out of the 5 prohibited acts under the Genocide Convention since the 7th of October. These include killing members of the group, causing them serious mental or bodily harm, and inflicting conditions of life calculated to bring about their physical destruction. For example, this would include the destruction of essential infrastructure, including homes, agricultural land, water and sanitation infrastructure, and infrastructure indispensable to the civilian population. They also include the mass repeated displacement under inhumane and unsanitary conditions. And they also include the deliberate obstruction of entry of life-saving supplies and aid.
Israel's intensifying its attacks on Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. An attack on an encampment in Al-Mawasi, a so-called safe zone, killed at least 21 people. Survivors described a fireball that incinerated people, including mothers and their children. Palestinians who gathered to grieve the dead responded to the Amnesty report.
The time has come for the international community to move on all fronts to question and hold Israel to account for the crimes, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide crimes that it is carrying out.
The massacre in Al-Mawasi was just one of multiple deadly attacks launched by Israel over the past day, killing at least 48 people overall. Attacks on the Indonesian hospital in northern Beit Lahia, which is also acting as shelter, set the facility's water tanks ablaze. Meanwhile, Israeli forces are continuing to attack southern Lebanon by air in violation of a ceasefire deal with Hezbollah. The far-right-dominated U.S. Supreme Court appears poised to uphold Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming care for transgender youth after hearing arguments in a case that could have major repercussions for transgender people across the country. Plaintiffs argue the ban is a form of sex discrimination. Transgender community members and their allies rallied in front of the Supreme Court Wednesday. This is Ethan Rice, an attorney with Lambda Legal, one of the groups representing the plaintiffs in the case.
To support trans youth and non-binary youth specifically, but, you know, really today is such an important case for our community, and really it's about the right of transgender youth to be themselves, the rights of parents and youth to be able to make medical decisions with their doctors.
After headlines, we'll speak with ACLU attorney Chase Strangio, who yesterday argued the case before the Supreme Court, becoming the first openly trans lawyer to speak before the court. The French government has collapsed after leftist and far-right lawmakers united to oust Prime Minister Michel Barnier in a no-confidence vote Wednesday. The vote came amidst intense opposition to Barnier's budget proposal and its roughly $60 billion in spending cuts and tax increases. It's the first time France's government has fallen to a no-confidence vote since 1962. French President Emmanuel Macron is addressing the nation later today. He would ask Barnier to stay on as caretaker prime minister and until he names a successor. It's the latest defeat for the embattled Macron, who faced fierce backlash after selecting the conservative Barnier as prime minister in September instead of a progressive politician, despite a leftist coalition winning the most votes in July's snap parliamentary elections. Mathilde Panot of the Progressive France Unbowed party called on Macron to step down following the vote.
We are ready to govern on a program of change. Emmanuel Macron must go, and we want to show any moment, and we will demonstrate that another world is always possible, and that the only sovereign in this country remains the people and them alone.
South Korean police are investigating President Yoon Suk-yeol for insurrection after his declaration of martial law Tuesday. Under South Korean law, anyone found guilty of leading an insurrection may receive a death sentence. Yoon was forced to revoke his martial law order 6 hours after announcing it amidst widespread opposition and mass protest. Opposition lawmakers Thursday introduced a motion to impeach Yoon, which is set to be voted on Saturday. This is lawmaker Kim Sung-won addressing the National Assembly.
There was a moment of military treason that we considered disappeared in the history. He has committed an unforgivable sin.
Syria's government says it's withdrawn its forces from Hama as armed opposition fighters began entering the key Syrian city. It's another major blow to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad after opposition fighters last week seized Aleppo, Syria's second largest city. Armed groups now control much of Syria's northern Idlib province, where civil defense workers report Russian airstrikes on 5 healthcare facilities have killed at least 18 people and injured nearly 36 others. Doctors and paramedics at Aleppo University Hospital say they're suffering severe shortages of personnel and medical supplies.
Hospitals are often put out of service. There's a lack of staff and equipment. All hospitals are out of service due to the bombing of the hospitals.
In the Republic of Georgia, authorities arrested a main opposition leader as mass anti-government protests stretched into their second week. Nika Gvaramia, head of the Coalition for Change, was one of multiple opposition figures to be detained Wednesday amidst government raids on homes and offices. The protests were set off after the ruling Georgian Dream Party suspended its bid to join the European Union. Meanwhile, Georgia's pro-EU president has refused to recognize Georgian Dream's recent victory in parliamentary elections and has called for new elections. In Belgium, a court had found the Belgian government guilty of crimes against humanity for the forced removal of 5 mixed-race children from their Congolese mothers during Belgium's colonization of their native country. The 5 women, now in their 70s, were abducted from their mothers between 1948 and 53 and placed in Catholic institutions. Thousands of mixed-race children endured the same state-sponsored seizure and mistreatment. One of the plaintiffs, Simone Golula, said the historic legal victory had restored her dignity. In other news from Belgium, a new law has gone into effect granting sex workers unprecedented labor rights, including sick days, health insurance, maternity pay, pensions, and the ability to set the terms of their services with clients. Employers of sex workers must ensure workplace protections and pass background checks. The changes come after years of organizing by Belgium's sex worker union. Back in the United States, Donald Trump has named former UC Irvine economist Peter Navarro as his top trade advisor. Navarro served as White House advisor in the first Trump administration before serving 4 months in a federal prison earlier this year after he was convicted of contempt of Congress for refusing to comply with a subpoena from the House January 6th committee. Navarro had boasted of working to delay Congress's count of the 2020 election results to buy time for Trump to reverse Joe Biden's victory. In more transition news, Trump's nominated Paul Atkins as head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, reprising his role under the George W. Bush administration. Atkins is co-chair of the cryptocurrency lobbying group, the Token Alliance, and has advocated against heavily regulating the rapidly growing cryptocurrency market. Trump has nominated billionaire tech entrepreneur and pilot Jared Isaacman to head NASA. Isaacman is a close ally of SpaceX CEO Elon Musk and has spent much of his personal fortune bankrolling private missions to space. President-elect Trump will appoint former Georgia Republican senator and top Trump campaign contributor Kelly Loeffler to lead the Small Business Administration. Trump has asked Fiserv CEO Frank Bisignano to head the Social Security Administration, has tapped his longtime lawyer David Warrington to serve as the White House counsel. Meanwhile, Trump will seek to nominate a new leader of the Internal Revenue Service to replace Biden appointee Daniel Werfel, who spent just 2 years on the job. Trump will instead seek Senate confirmation of former Missouri Congressmember Billy Long as IRS commissioner. Long's nomination comes as Republicans are seeking to prevent the Treasury Department from unlocking $20 billion in IRS enforcement money that's been effectively frozen during budget negotiations. A U.S. Justice Department investigation has found Memphis police guilty of using excessive force and discriminating against black people. The probe was launched after the killing of Tyree Nichols, a 29-year-old black father who was beaten to death by police during a 2023 traffic stop. The Memphis Police Department says it will not agree to federal oversight and reforms until it can review and challenge the Justice Department's report. A manhunt is underway here in New York after a shooter killed the CEO of United Healthcare, Brian Thompson, outside a Manhattan hotel Wednesday morning in what police said was a brazen targeted attack. The gunman shot Thompson as he was entering the New York Hilton Midtown for United Healthcare's annual investor conference. The motive for Thompson's killing has not been confirmed, but his widow told NBC News he'd received threats due to, quote, a lack of coverage. Police say they found shell casings with the words depose, deny, and defend inscribed on them. The words delay, deny, defend are known as the three Ds of the health insurance industry. And Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield in Connecticut, New York, and Missouri has announced it'll stop paying for patients' anesthesia for the full length of surgeries if the procedure goes over an allotted time limit. Donald Arnold, president of American Society of Anesthesiologists, said, quote, this is just the latest in a long line of appalling behavior by commercial health insurers looking to drive their profits up at the expense of patients and physicians, he said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, the Supreme Court appears poised to uphold Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming care for transgender youth. Stay with us.
It's time to forget. Wasn't always this way. Taught to admit I was the one. You still love me anyway. You still love me anyway. Autumn came in December when time to down a high school dance. You still love me anyway. You still love me anyway.
Love Me Anyway by Chappelle Roan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. Supreme Court appears poised to uphold Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming care for transgender youth after hearing arguments in a case that could have major repercussions for transgender people across the United States. The Biden administration and the American Civil Liberties Union argued against the ban, saying it's a form of tax of sex discrimination. But Chief Justice John Roberts and other right-wing justices appeared to reject that argument. After the oral arguments, Tennessee Attorney General Jonathan Scrimeti spoke outside the Supreme Court.
The people of Tennessee, acting through a bipartisan supermajority of their elected officials, made a similar choice. They passed SB1 to protect kids. Half the states in the United States have done the same. The Constitution allows the states to protect kids from unproven, life-altering procedures based on uncertain science. The states have exercised the power to regulate the practice of medicine for hundreds of years. The dramatic and unexplained increase in the use of these life-altering procedures on kids is exactly the sort of situation where the state should take notice and regulate. Now, adolescence is hard, and gender dysphoria is a heavy burden, and we need to remember that. But the evidence shows that the large majority of kids dealing with gender dysphoria will grow out of it unless they're put on these medications.
ACLU attorney Chase Strangio also spoke outside the Supreme Court shortly after making history as the first openly trans lawyer to argue before the Supreme Court.
And today we were able to stand before this court and say the Constitution protects trans people just like it protects everyone else. It is breaking no new ground to recognize that when you are prohibited from receiving something because of your sex, that it is the role of the courts to ensure that the government can satisfy its burden of showing that it has a good reason for doing so. Tennessee did not meet their burden. This law, we believe, is unconstitutional. And perhaps the scariest thing for all of us is that Tennessee's arguments would apply if Congress tomorrow banned this care nationally for adolescents, for adults. They claim that there are no protections based on sex for the transgender people who, like myself, who rely on this medical care.
That was ACLU attorney Chase Strangio, who argued before the Supreme Court. He'll join us live in a moment. But first, I want to turn to excerpts of Wednesday's oral arguments. This is Tennessee Solicitor General Matthew Rice, followed by Liberal Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
Our position is that there is no sex-based classification, but to finish the answer, that to the extent that a law with dealing with adults would pass rational basis review, that just means it's left to the democratic process and that democracy is the best check on potentially misguided laws.
So in
when you're 1% of the population, you're 1% of the population or less, very hard to see how the democratic process is going to protect you.
Well, Your Honor,
blacks were a much larger part of the population, and it didn't protect them. It didn't protect women for whole centuries.
During the oral arguments, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who was appointed to the Supreme Court by Donald Trump, asked if trans people have ever been discriminated against.
We just head-on confront the question which you raise in the second part of your brief about whether transgender status should be a suspect class. One question I have is, at least as far as I can think of, we don't have a history of de jure, or that I know of, we don't have a history of de jure discrimination against transgender people, right?
So I think you may be right that the discrimination, historical discrimination against transgender people may not have been reflected in the laws, but I think there's no dispute that there is a broad history here, and it hasn't just been confined to private actors. I think that if you actually looked at the facts, there's a wealth of evidence to suggest that transgender people throughout history have been subjected to violence and discrimination and maybe lost employment opportunities or housing opportunities, even in contexts where there might be state public employment at play.
That was U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar responding to a question from Justice Amy Coney Barrett. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, who was appointed by Joe Biden, expressed concern that the court was moving to undermine the foundations of what she called bedrock equal protection cases. She cited the 1967 decision in Loving versus Virginia that struck down a state ban on interracial marriage.
And I guess my real concern, and maybe I'll just ask you to react to my Loving parallel because I'm getting kind of nervous, is that in Loving, those same kinds of scientific arguments were made. So I'm reading here where the court says the argument is that if the Equal Protection Clause does not outlaw miscegenation statutes because of their reliance on racial classifications, the question of constitutionality would thus become whether there was any rational basis for a state to treat interracial marriages differently from other marriages. On this question, the state argues, the scientific evidence is substantially in doubt, and consequently, the court should defer to the wisdom of the state legislature in adopting its policy of discouraging interracial marriages. And so for me, this kind of idea that the way we look at it is not first, are you drawing these classifications, and then state, give us your evidence so we can make sure that there's a proper fit. If instead we're just sort of doing what the state is encouraging here in Loving, where you just sort of say, well, there are lots of good reasons for this policy, and who are we as the court to say otherwise, I'm worried that we're undermining the foundations of some of our bedrock equal protection cases.
I share your concerns, Justice Jackson. I think one of the things that's happening in this case is we're seeing a lot of concerns that come in at step two of the analysis being imported into that threshold question of whether a classification has been drawn in the first instance. Concerns about real differences between males and females. That is exactly what heightened scrutiny is intended to test in the application of heightened scrutiny. If Tennessee can have an end run around heightened scrutiny by asserting at the outset that biology justifies the sex-based differential in the law, that would undermine decades of this court's precedent.
That was ACLU attorney Chase Strangio responding to Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. Chase is co-director of the American Civil Liberties Union's LGBTQ and HIV Project. On Wednesday, he became the first openly transgender lawyer to argue a case before the Supreme Court. Chase, however this turns out, you have made history. Can you talk first about just the experience of being in the Supreme Court? Describe the nut of this case and how you think it went. What were you most surprised by?
Well, thank you, Amy. It's good to be with you and to relive some of those moments, which when you're in it, you don't necessarily really internalize it as it's happening. And so I'm still replaying everything in my mind. I'll sort of speak first to what it felt like in the courtroom yesterday. And the first thing I'll say is that it was incredible to have so many advocates who have worked to defend trans people for so long. And of course, notably yesterday, we were defended by the United States through the Solicitor General, who was up at the lectern for over an hour answering questions about the straightforward claims that both the United States and the private plaintiffs represented by ACLU and Lambda Legal and Akin Gump were making, which is that there is a sex-based classification in this law. It is very difficult to try to explain that away because on the face of the statute that Tennessee passed, they say you cannot have treatment when it's inconsistent with your sex. And I think one of the striking things about yesterday's argument is that the Solicitor General of Tennessee could not find his way out of that straightforward reality of the law that the Tennessee legislature passed that he was trying to defend on the ground that it was sex neutral. Now, all of the conversations in the argument about the alleged risks of the treatment and what's happening in Europe, none of that changes. First of all, it's completely distorted. But of course, none of that changes that Tennessee's law draws this sex-based classification. And that is what Justice Jackson was really trying to get at the end, is that we are not doing this analysis correctly. And she really refocused us on that point.
This is Tennessee Solicitor General Matthew Rice speaking during Wednesday's Supreme Court oral arguments, interrupted by Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
As Justice Kavanaugh recognized throughout his questioning, they cannot stand up here and say that if these alternatives were imposed, that there would be no detransitioners. So they cannot eliminate the risk of detransitioners. So it becomes a pure exercise of weighing benefits versus risk. And the question of how many minors have to have their bodies irreparably harmed for unproven benefits is one that is best left.
I'm sorry, Counselor. Every medical treatment has a risk, even taking aspirin. There is always going to be a percentage of the population under any medical treatment that's going to suffer a harm.
That's Justice Sotomayor interrupting Tennessee Solicitor General Matthew Rice. Talk about the significance of this moment, Chase.
One thing I'll say that was really powerful was just how passionate, particularly Justices Sotomayor and Jackson were yesterday. Sotomayor focused extensively on the harms to the adolescents at the center of this case and who are having their health care stripped away. And the point I think that she is making that is so important in that exchange with the Solicitor General of Tennessee is that Tennessee is getting up there and saying, we can do this because this medication carries risk. Now, the district court in this case found found that Tennessee's allegations of harm and their prevalence were simply not supported by the record. But then, importantly, there is no medical intervention that does not carry risk. That is part of medicine, balancing the risks and benefits. And in all other circumstances, what Tennessee does is allow doctors and parents and then adolescent patients to weigh those risks and benefits and make a decision about what is best for the individual patient. What Tennessee has done here is displaced that thoughtful, often painstaking process that parents and their children have gone through with their doctors and imposed this one-size-fits-all prohibition. And Tennessee really did struggle to justify that sweeping ban that they passed.
Chase, talk about the origins of this Tennessee case. Talk about who Scrimeti is and who the people are you're representing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the origins have to be placed in the context of this was a law that of what was going on nationally. This was a law that was passed in 2023 at a time when almost half the country passed laws just like it. These are not homegrown, constituent driven pieces of legislation. These are model bills that are shipped out to legislatures across the country and then rushed through supermajority legislatures that have an anti-trans objective and orientation. So that's the context. They passed the law in March of 2023, and we shortly after filed a lawsuit to seek to have that law enjoined because we knew that hundreds of adolescents in Tennessee would lose their health care, and future individuals who needed the health care would not be able to access it. We represent three adolescents and their parents who had been receiving this medical care in Tennessee, had that medical care cut off by operation of the law that was passed in March of that year, and then also represent a doctor, Dr. Susan Lacey, who provides this medical treatment both to cisgender and transgender individuals and was barred from providing the medication to her transgender patients. And so we represented her as well, and we filed the lawsuit shortly after the law was passed by the legislature and then have been litigating this case over the past 2 years. And when we lost at the federal appeals court overturning the lower court's injunction of the law, in essence allowing the law to go into effect, we took it to the Supreme Court.
Were you surprised by the fact that the Trump appointee, Neil Gorsuch, did not speak? Particularly interesting because he authored a 2020 ruling protecting transgender rights in the workplace. The case, of course, isn't the same, but the significance of this.
So, you know, you come out of these arguments and obviously you can't predict what the justices are thinking, even based on their questions. And it was striking, as everyone has noted, that Justice Gorsuch did not say anything during the argument. I don't know what that means. Obviously, we think that the Justice Gorsuch's opinion, majority opinion in Bostock, that logic of that opinion clearly applies here. In Bostock, the court held that if an employer fires someone for being transgender, they are intentionally discriminating against them in part based on their sex. And that is because to discriminate against someone for being transgender is to discriminate against them because they have a gender identity different from their birth sex. That is exactly what this law does. It draws a line based on the fact that someone has a gender identity that differs from their birth sex. So there is a clear logical parallel between Bostock and the Tennessee law and our claims in this case. The fact that Justice Gorsuch did not engage in the argument doesn't necessarily tell us anything. Sometimes justices don't ask questions because they feel that the answers to the questions they had were presented in the legal briefs, in the written briefs. So we'll wait to see how he is thinking about this case in relation to Bostock, in relation to the constitutional jurisprudence that we relied on. And that's all we can really do is wait and see until they decide this case in June.
I want to turn to Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan, who questioned the Tennessee Solicitor General Matthew Rice about the purpose of the Tennessee law.
Can I ask you about one of the purposes of this law? And I note that your brief does not talk a lot about this, but one of the articulated purposes of this law is essentially to encourage gender conformity and to discourage anything other than gender conformity. And I'm